Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride!
And hello. This is the Three Horsemen podcast, courtesy of SF Signal. My name is John Stevens, and I am one of the, not one, but three hosts that we have on this podcast. And with me tonight, of course, as usual, are Jeff Patterson.
Hi there, Jeff Patterson. Blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at baddaystudio.com. JeffPatterson11 on Twitter.
And in the other chair is Mr. Fred Kish.
And good evening, it's Fred Kish. I can be found on Twitter as @FredKish or through my blog, Bernal Alpha.
Excellent. And how many books are you up to right now?
Only 18 for the year to date. March has been a very bad month.
Oh, my Lord.
Slacking, Fred. Slacking.
Slacking for all the good reasons.
And I didn't do my little spiel. I'm John Stevens, and I am a columnist and a writer. And you see me on SF Signal sometimes, hopefully more frequently in the future. I have a woefully under-contributed to blog at J.H. Stevens WordPress. And I'm more likely snarfing around on Twitter as Iredite Ogre. And also, you can see reviews of stuff that I do, shorter reviews, on my Goodreads account. And there is that. So, tonight, we are, shockingly, going to focus on one topic. But it's a very large topic. The topic tonight is anthologies.
It contains multitudes.
It does. It contains multitudes upon multitudes, wrapped in enigmas, shrouded in mysteries. And, We each decided to read a few anthologies and discuss what we like about anthologies, what appeals to us, and talk about some of our favorites. And I was interested. I actually got kind of weird about this. I was going through my stacks of anthologies, and I was really surprised at the number of anthologies I actually own. I got up to about 200 and then I just stopped counting because it was just getting embarrassing. But the interesting thing to me at first was to think about the idea of the anthology. And I just went and looked up the definition on the dictionary, which is very straightforward. You know, it's a book or other collection of stories. But the roots of it are very interesting because the literal etymology of the term is a collection of flowers. And originally, for a long time, pertained to poetry solely. And then eventually was expanded to include collections of stories. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And thinking about anthologies, I thought, thinking about why I like anthologies, I thought that somehow that's kind of apt because my favorite anthologies are sort of like that. They're this sort of this really beautiful bundle of words that I really get a lot out of and can go back to time and time again. But, Jeff, do you want to start talking about what you like about anthologies?
Well, yeah, because when I came into my full blossom, to stay with the theme, of fandom in my early teens, anthologies were pretty instrumental in me learning more and more about the genre itself. I had read, you know, quite a few novels, but I discovered, you know, Dangerous Visions and the Orbit series and stuff like that. And it was through that I actually learned a lot about authors who either had not published a lot of novels or who I had not found on the bookstands at the local used bookstore that I used to go to in Springfield, Mass. And two things that I wanted to mention about that period was that, number one, I did not realize this at the time, but right around that time is when anthologies started to get a little bit experimental and would sometimes be like the best of an individual publisher or be the best of an author who had not, you know, seen print in a while. And it was not until a few weeks ago when I started, you know, digging through once. I don't think there's an anthology I haven't bought, John, so I would not be surprised if I have well over 200. But as I was digging through this and I was looking at like all my Omni, you know, books of science fiction that I had and looked at some of the old Orbits, I did not have an appreciation at the time for just how eclectic some of the anthologies that I read in my formative, you know, years were. Mm-hmm. 2 points I wanted to make on this. Number one, there was an anthology called Epic by Roger Elwood and Robert Silverberg, which considered itself the state of the art of SF now. When it came out, I believe that was 75 that came out. And it came out in paperback, and it had people like Le Guin and Fred Pohl and Clifford Simak, who I had read before, but that was the first time I had read Jack Dann, and the first time I had read Kate Wilhelm and A.A. Atanasio, and John Shirley had one of his earliest stories in there. And it may have been, that may have been the first Jack Vance I read in there. And that book really much, pretty much kind of tried to bridge between the Golden Age and what was going on in SF in the 70s, and even touching on things like the New Weird and stuff like that. And it I remember loving the book when I read it, more so than I had enjoyed Dangerous Visions and stuff like that. But it was not until I looked back in preparation for this that I said to myself, wow, this is really a key anthology when it comes to creating a continuity of SF. Which is something I talked about in the past. The other thing I wanted to mention was, and we can talk about this later, Pamela Sargent's Women of Wonder books all came out around that time. Mm-hmm. And the beat that they laid down, you know, led to, you know, other books like Millennial Women, which was Virginia Kidd's anthology that came out. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, I had kind of homogenized all these series, you know, these anthologies that had come out. And it wasn't until I went back in prep for this again and started reading, you know, Women of Wonder and Millennial Women and a few others that I had, that I started seeing that they were really taking significantly different approaches to what was basically a very simplistic, broad stroke, you know, anthology mission. Millennial Women, which was basically, I mean, you could say it was an excuse to print a new Le Guin novel, which is what it had been marketed with in a while. But that was where, you know, Elizabeth A. Lynn and Diana Paxton, was the first time I read their stuff and was actually kind of surprised that I wasn't finding more stuff like that in that period. Mm-hmm. Those were the books that really got me hooked on anthology. So as the 80s roll around and the Omni books of science fiction start coming out and we start seeing Ace, you know, generate their very narrowly focused anthology series, all of which I pretty much enjoyed, I was already preconditioned to it. At that point,
right.
I was already hooked on that particular format, and enjoyed it almost to the exclusion of a lot of other, you know, anthologies that were done by publisher or by author at the time. So that's my little intro to it. So,
well, it's funny you mentioned encountering Jack Vance for the first time in an anthology, because I actually had the same experience. My first exposure to Jack Vance was actually from one of the old Flashing Swords anthologies that mm-hmm. Carter did. Morion, I think, was the story. I remember it because it was this collection built of sort of like, you know, beat 'em up sword and sorcery, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the middle of that is this Jack Vance story that is anything really but that. And just, it was just so compelling that I just ran right out and started, you know, scooping up Jack Vance. Mm. So, you know, and I mean, it's funny you talk about the formative work of anthologies. I think for me, it's a little different, but I thought I would actually get Fred's first salvo first before I commented.
Well, just to, let's see, I think I've got 200 odd ebook anthologies, and I don't know how many paper anthologies, and I think there's only 25% overlap between the two.
Uh-huh.
So my first exposures were way back in the early days of the universe when my parents would go to rummage sales and yard sales and pick up copies from SF Science Fiction Book Club anthologies and store them for the year and put them away and then give them to me for Christmas. So I think my first one might have been Anthony Boucher's 2-volume Science Fiction Treasury that Science Fiction Book Club sold for decades, it seemed. And then Robert Silverberg, Science Fiction Hall of Fame, Volume 1. And then Volume 2A and 2B. John Campbell doing a really big fat anthology of Astounding Stories.
Yeah, I remember that.
And as with you, Jeff, Orbit, which is where I first came across Delaney and many other people I still read today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we'll go into this more later, but you know, I love a good themed anthology. I love a good shared world anthology. But I just as much love all the annuals, you know, Gardner Dessois or Jonathan Strawn, or I mean, how many annuals are there at this point? Like six or seven? You know, it's a great way of finding new writers. That's my best reason I keep reading anthologies. I keep finding that's where I first read Ken Liu or Neil Gaiman, or I mean, you know, even Samuel Delaney and all these other people that I still read.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first place I read them was for all these anthologies.
Right. Wow. That's funny because I think for me, I didn't get into anthologies right away when I started reading science fiction and fantasy. I really liked the novel length experience. And it wasn't until someone actually gave me a couple of anthologies, a couple of the old Orbit anthologies to read, that I started reading short stories and realized what I was missing. And then from there, what I ended up doing, I think, was not looking for new writers so much as looking for short work by the writers I already loved. And that's part of the reason why, for example, I picked up the Flashing Swords anthologies initially, at least the first couple of volumes, because there were writers in it that I knew. And then the funny thing would be that I would then find new writers. But it was always more of a revelation than me actually seeking them out. And now there's sort of a weird reversal where I feel more like short stories are more interesting to me sometimes because I find there's more experimentation, a little more risk-taking in short form than in novel form. And there have been periods of time in the past where that wasn't the case, where novels were definitely more, weirdly more seeking the cutting edge than short stories. But I think nowadays it's much more shorter fiction is doing the really interesting and strange stuff.
Well, the publishers want the same formula for novels because that's what's been selling. So they'd rather do a trilogy or a quintology or heptapetology or whatever.
A dodecadology?
Yeah. However big you want to make it.
Or whatever you want to call it. The Chung Kao novels, which are supposed to be 20 of them in the reprint versions.
Yeah, so it's a short story. It's got less investment or whatever. You can take a bigger risk.
Well, and I think the shifts in the market have made that even more the case.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the shifts to electronic format and a lot more independent publishing, you see, I think, a lot more experimentation at the story level. And you see magazine editors in some venues much more willing to do the experimentation to take a chance than you. So I think that's true to an extent. And it's unfortunate because I'm worried that some of the experimental spirit doesn't translate up in a lot of cases to the longer work. Maybe like what you said, Fred, because of sort of market demands. But it would be great if, you know, this new bold frontier of self-publishing resulted in a lot more experimentation. It doesn't seem to. It almost seems like people do more sort of bread and butter writing independently than taking chances. But anyway, to get back to the topic, there's a tangent. I'm going with it. So having talked a little bit now about our experience with it, I'm curious to hear what anthologies you wanted to highlight. Ooh. And yeah, Jeff, what'd you have?
I want to say one thing. When we talk about anthologies, we have to, as much as we enjoy the content and as much as we enjoy the delivery format, we have to talk about the editors a little bit, because obviously they're the ones who are orchestrating everything. And an example I want to give as to the impact of an editor and how they take different approaches to them. I got two anthologies in front of me. One of them is Black Mist and Other Japanese Futures. It was edited by Orson Scott Card and Keith Farrell. And it came out in 97. The other one I have is called Future Earths Under South American Skies. It was edited by Mike Resnick and Gardner Dozois, and it came out in 93. Future Earths is primarily reprints, and it's got a lot of excellent reprints. It's got, you know, The Women Men Don't See by Tiptree, and it's got an old Will Jenkins story from 1949, and it's got Charles Sheffield and Abram Davidson. But it is primarily reprints, wherein the Black Mist book Under Japanese Futures is all news stories. Both of these books are excellent anthologies, but one is repurposing and reprinting, and the other one went out and got new material. Both of these, as I'm certain, you know, a lot of editors would tell us, are two completely and utterly different disciplines. Even though the raw discipline of editing an anthology is primarily the same, when you're thinking about putting something together and you're trying to hammer a message or a theme home, and you decide to do it via reprints or even partial reprints, like we've seen in some of the John Joseph Adams books, you're not only adding a bit of depth and continuity to it, but you're also you're repurposing stuff that's been previously collected and stuff like that to fit into a particular theme or to have a particular overall flavor to a given anthology. And I think that's kind of important to point that out, because you end up with a number of, you know, anthologies that, while they may not be in direct competition or are looking for the same set of readers, in one case you're trying to drum up something new and fresh and never before seen, as opposed to trying to give the reader the experience of a given theme over the history of SF. And I just wanted to use those two books, which both, they're taking on a cultural approach to science fiction stories in two completely different ways, and they both nail it, but they're two completely different animals, and I just wanted to point that out. The books I wanted to highlight, I'm going to go a little bit older. Actually, I'm not going to go as far deep as the 70s. I'm going to go back to 1996. The book was called Space Opera. It was edited by Anne McCaffrey and Elizabeth Ann Scarborough, and it was an anthology of science fiction stories focusing on vocal music. It had The Impossible Place by Alan Dean Foster. It had Peter Beagle, Mary C. Pangborn. And once again, it had a number of authors who, at the time it came out, I had not read before. It's got Blueberry Jam by Gene Wolfe. And it was a... At the time that it came out, I bought it and said, that's a weird idea for an anthology. And yet it blew me away. Rondelet by Mary Pangborn is such a wonderful story. Stephen Brust is in it, Margaret Ball. And this was all new stuff. And Saskia by Charles DeLint, which is a story that still stays with me. And it was interesting because it was one of those situations where a publisher said to someone, "Hey, do an anthology," and you sort of build it from, you know, the ground up. And it was such an interesting numerous takes on such a subject, which you would think would be, wow, what a narrow subject for science fiction stories, when in fact it's not. The fact that these stories come from as big of a scope as they do is very impressive. And I actually had just found another copy of it last year at a local used bookstore, and it's one of those things I really wish, because most of the stories that are in here I don't think have been recollected that often. And it's too bad, because it really should be. Robin Wayne Bailey's Song Child, I don't think I've ever seen that anywhere else except for here. I could be wrong, and if I am wrong, I hope somebody corrects me. That's one. The other one I wanted to mention about is Ben Bova and Eric Choi's Carbide Tip Pens from last year. And I wanted to, out of all the ones that have come out recently, this was the one that kind of resonated with me a bit, because it was their attempt to sort of do a bit of a callback to hard SF, but they wanted to, you know, show the implications of technological change. And one of the things that struck me about this anthology, which I don't want to say it's retro because it's a very contemporary anthology, but it has a very retro aesthetic when it comes to demonstrating the impact of a technology and how it can be put to use. But wherein so many golden and silver age technology science fiction stories tended to be almost obliquely optimistic, this one kind of really splits it down the middle between good and bad outcomes, and sometimes both in the course of the same story. And it really kind of hammered home, because it reminded me quite a bit of the two Futures from Nature anthologies, which are those short shorts that appear in the back of Nature magazine. In those anthologies, you run into things like, you're doing these really short, hard-hit flash fiction type things, and sometimes you make them incredibly wonderful. But if you can do a very short piece where you build a world and then give you a shocking, horrifying ending, it tends to have a bit more impact. And this anthology reminded me quite a bit of that. It's got Doug Beeson, it's got Jack McDevitt, Robert Reed, Kate Story, The Yoke of Inauspicious Stars, which is a wonderful little story, gave such a wide palette, is what it was. It had such scope in the way that it brought these particular tales about technology. And when you're putting them into this type of a context, it really fanned the cards out very wide, and I was very, very happy with it. Also got to mention that our friend Leah Peterson has a story in here with Gabrielle Harbowie, and I saw her read it at World Fantasy, actually, called Skin Deep. So
nice. Cool. Fred?
Well, I'm going to also mostly go back in time. It's probably widely perceived that I'm generally just a hard science fiction sort of reader, which is why I'm going to talk about a fantasy series anthology.
Good.
And a superhero series anthology. The first is Lynn Abbey and Robert Lynn Asprin's Thieves World series, which first came out in the late 70s, and as far as I know, was probably the first shared world series in existence. I'm not aware of anything other than something like Star Trek or Star Wars that was a shared world kind of thing, and those were both media properties, and at that point had a very limited number of participating authors. So what Robert Lynn Aspirin wanted to do was to do this, you know, kind of like mosaic novel, and he started pitching it, and he really was clever in that he would play one author after another and say to, like, Philip Jose Farmer, well, you know, John Brunner's already got a character in mind, and, you know, and so on and so forth. So he built up this city, and it takes place in a fantasy empire, kind of a rundown city where there's lots of interesting characters. The stories kind of play off each other in that the consequences of one can appear in another. The series initially, I think, ran for 9 books before it started splitting off into novels. And that's kind of where it started to fall apart, I think. Lynn Abbey tried to reboot the series in the early 2000s. Came out with some old stories, some new stories, and a novel. Unfortunately, it didn't seem to get any traction, which is a shame. And the other thing that's interesting about this is that we now in the fantasy role-playing arena have Open Gaming and Pathfinder and D&D and all sorts of things like this. Chaosium, when Thieves' World first came out, got the rights to the books, and instead of doing an exclusive setting for their game RuneQuest, did kind of an Open Gaming thing where they had the stats for D&D, the stats for Traveler, the stats for Fantasy Trip, and all the other big games of the time in the one box instead of just their own material. So if you look through the recent reprint, you'll see names that you know. Some were very, very new back then. Some were veterans already, so it's a nice mix of old and new. Different styles. The second shared world series that I want to talk about was created by this little known at that point guy, mostly worked on television on the show called Beauty and the Beast. This guy, George Martin. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of him. Of course, now you've heard of Game of Thrones, but back then George Martin was mostly a couple of science fiction novels. Worked on Outer Limits and things like that, and was mostly the showrunner, I think is what the term is used now, on Beauty and the Beast, which was a series, if no one's ever seen it, about a New York City detective who finds this kind of underworld where a man, mutant, disfigured person, whatever you want to say, named Vincent lives, and he would help her out. Interesting series. It ran for a couple of seasons. Unfortunately, at one point, they lost the star Linda Hamilton, and the second star was not just up to snuff, but some interesting stuff there. Anyway, George Martin was running a superhero role-playing game, Superworld from Chaosium, speaking of Chaosium, for his friends, people like Melinda Snodgrass, and he would spend so much time writing the adventure, running the adventure, writing up notes for the adventure, that at some point he decided, wouldn't it be better to write stories and get them published and have somebody pay me for this? And he got people like Roger Zelazny, Walter John Williams, Melinda Snodgrass, and many, many other names involved, and produced a series of novels and short story collections and mosaic novels that have gone across, at this point, 4 different publishers. Starting out at Bantam in the, I believe it was the mid-80s, to this point now it's with Tor Books, and I think they're up to book number 21 or 22 at this point. And we've had the Vietnam War, we've had politics, we've had Tahiti, we've had counterculture, we've had magic, science fiction, aliens, all sorts of stuff has been thrown in here, just like any long-running comic series from Marvel or DC. So those are my two big ones. I mean, I can continue with two smaller ones if you want, or we can swap off to you, John, and then come back or whatever.
Okay, I'd like to throw one thing in here when you talk about wild cards, because there was in the years immediately leading up to the release of Star Wars, Byron Preece had a series of books called the Weird Heroes books. mm-hmm. which were, you know, they weren't a shared universe. I think a couple of the stories actually crossed over on one another, but basically he had a lot of established authors either create characters or tell new stories of established characters that they had, and they would pair them up with various illustrators to do them. And I remember having read most of these books right before Star Wars came out. So when Star Wars came out, it wasn't that weird of a thing for me as it was for a lot of culture that wasn't really brought up on pulps. But it was interesting because as with the Wildcard books, where you were creating this entire universe, one of the interesting things about these books were that they would pair authors up with different illustrators, which you really wouldn't think wouldn't snap into your head. I mean, you know, there's an Orion story in here by Ben Bova that P. Craig Russell does the illustration for. And there's an Edmund Hamilton story that has Alex Nino drawings with it, which are not, you know, writer-illustrator pairings that would immediately leap to mind. But at the time, I had never seen an illustrated story done like this before, and so it was kind of neat. But I remember having read those books, so when the Wildcard books came out, I was like, ah, this is neat. Someone's taking, you know, that idea and really extending it into, yes, this is actually a shared universe with its own history, etc. So,
well, Thieves' World was in the 70s, not Wildcards.
Right.
So I'm not sure if these paralleled Thieves' World or not.
They would have been out right around the same time. I want to say It started in 74.
All right, so that did beat it.
Yeah.
Okay.
But like I said, it wasn't necessarily a shared universe, but it was a common vision trying to create fairly contemporary characters in the mold of pulp heroes.
All right, so that, yeah, and that is similar to what Wild Cards did do.
Right.
Because you've got Jet Boy, who's very much a World War II kind of Rocket Man, but then you've got Roger Zelazny's character, which is more like a Doctor Strange or...
Yeah.
You know, then you've got sex magic versus regular superheroes and all sorts of stuff. So,
cool. So,
I can go on, or I can go on, or we can come back.
I'll jump in, do mine, okay. And then we can do a little more discussing. As I probably indicated by my earlier discussion, I had a really hard time narrowing the field.
Yeah, I did see some tweets that kind of indicated that.
Yeah. And then I actually read something, a book I hadn't read in quite a long time, and decided I didn't like it as much as I did the first time, so I chose something else. What I was initially going to talk about was an anthology by Ursula K. Le Guin and Virginia Kidd called Edges.
Oh, good one.
Yeah, but some of those stories just didn't hold up for me this
time.
Yeah,
that's true.
It's kind of a mixed bag. I was surprised. There's some really, really good stories in here, and the writing quality is pretty good, but a few of them just felt firmly in the center rather than being on the edge. Mm-hmm. There's a great story in here by what's it called, by Scott Sanders, called Touch the Earth, which is one of the better stories I've ever read about I guess you would say hypochondriac dystopia, where a group of people who are in a hermetically sealed city go out into the world that they've been told is a disaster and set to be a lush wilderness, and try to learn how to deal with that again. And the details are really well done, and the story is interesting too. It's a compelling story, and the characters are really fascinating to see. And I think he actually does a really good job of getting into their heads, and, you know, thinking, if I had been sealed up all my life in a completely, you know, pristine city cut off from the real world, how would I react? And it's very well done. And that, I think that's, for me, is still my favorite of the series in the book. But then there are others like Gene Wolfe's Suzanne Delage, which is very well written, but it was one of those sort of puzzle stories that didn't really have any mystery to it. And even the Thomas Dish offering in here with the Vengeance of Hera is very satirical. It's definitely a very Thomas Dish story, but it just felt very flat. So I decided to jettison that, and even though I've already talked about it. But, I mean, it was interesting to me because I was looking for anthologies that try to deal with sort of stories from out of sort of the mainstream. Like, a lot of thematic volumes really get stories that are not very experimental. They're not really taking a lot of chances. They're very focused on the theme of the anthology, and they often tend to be very straightforward narratively. And I've been looking through some of the more sort of cutting-edge anthologies from the past to see if I could find something interesting. And certainly the Dangerous Vision series did that a lot. And some of those stories are still really, really powerful. But then I picked up something odd. I picked up, I think it's actually it's supposed to be a college textbook, called Extreme Fiction, Fabulous and Formalists. And when I looked inside, I was kind of surprised to find that it had a number of science fiction fantasy authors in it, and that one of the conceits of the book is that they're looking at fiction that does things very differently from the accepted formula of mimetic realism. So you've got Borges, you've got Angela Carter, you've got Flann O'Brien, you've got Ricky Ducournay, and you've also got Octavia Butler. And it's really, it was really an interesting read. J.G. Ballard's story. And they're not interested in the genre so much as what the story does. And the vision of the book is there's a section called for fabulists, people who are telling stories using what they call the irreal, which they lump science fiction and fantasy under. We're sort of telling stories that aren't realistic. They're not supposed to be realistic in any way. And then the second section is with people who they lump together as formalists, who are experimenting with form, who are breaking up narrative, doing things like collage stories and stories in parallel columns, experimenting with the very form of the words themselves. And that section had some really good stuff in it. In fact, the Ballard story from the atrocity exhibition planned for the assassination of Jacqueline Kennedy is in that section. But I was really struck by the amazing things people were doing with what I would consider fantasy tropes, motifs, and sensibilities, but they weren't lumped under that rubric. So while there's stories like Borges' Aleph in here, which is one of my favorite Borges stories, there's also a lot of great stories from people who I had never heard of before. There's a really great story by by Barry Hanna called Water Liars. And it's a fairly short story, and it's about this guy who goes fishing and is basically standing on this pier with a bunch of old men who are basically telling, big fish stories. And what he ends up doing with that is so fascinating, and how he reverses ideas of truth and lies in like the space of like a half dozen pages, is that I was just really blown away.
Mm.
And there's some stories that folks who are familiar with science fiction and fantasy will know about, like Octavia Butler's Blood Child is the selection they have in here. And the funny thing about that is that just goes off like a bomb in the middle of this anthology. Because that one really goes a lot farther into sort of science fictional territory than any of the others. But it sits really comfortably at the top of the pile almost. I mean, it's definitely one of the best stories in the collection. And when set side by side with these other stories, it's interesting to see what these stories have borrowed from what we consider science fiction and fantasy, and what science fiction and fantasy authors have sort of taken from the history of the novel and the short story. So that's my first choice as something to put out there for people to look at, because they're taking chances, but it's not just haha in your face, I'm doing this funny trick sort of writing. almost all the stories, with very few exceptions, really have a really sharp emotional or narrative point to make, and they do it really well. And the ones that actually fail are the ones that I think are most messing around. There's a story in the formalist section by Stephen Dixon called Milk is Very Good for You, which attempts to play with the idea of pornography by changing the first letter of each quote-unquote dirty word. And it's supposed to make you think about, you know, the constructiveness of language, blah, blah, blah. But it seems like a 12-year-old is playing, you know, with the computer and found a penthouse story and decided to play with the words. So that just didn't work. But what I was really surprised to find was that so many of the stories did really work really well. And a lot of them are what we would consider, what we'd probably call science fiction or fantasy or magical realist or slipstream. But it was just a great collection of stories. And with that link that it had with those authors to the genre we talk about, I thought it was a good entry and something for people to explore. The other selection I had came out of what I was thinking about in terms of how anthologies are done. You know, Jeff pointed out earlier that there's a way that, you know, editors choose to, you know, do reprints or do all new stories or do a mix. And it's funny, what I thought of as I was looking at anthologies was how they're organized in terms of how they organize their stories. So we have lots of best of collections that are, you know, the best of the year or the best of the field. We have collections like this extreme fiction collection that I'm talking about, that are sort of best of, but not best of the year necessarily. They're sort of the best that the editor thinks they are. And Le Guin and Kids volume, my understanding is, was one of those kind of collections. It wasn't just, you know, the best of the year. It was stories that they thought were on the quote-unquote cutting edge. But then you have thematic anthologies, which I think is what often first comes to mind when you think of an anthology. And as I was looking through the ones that I have of those, the one that immediately popped into my head is one I love to talk about at any opportunity, is Anna Jeff Vandermeer's Thackeray T. Lambshead Cabinet of Curiosities.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
It's an incredibly strong volume of writing, first of all. I mean, they got a great pile of authors. They got Ellen Moore, China Mieville, Caitlin Kernan.
Who isn't in it?
What?
Who isn't in it?
Yeah. It's really amazing. And they also got Helen Yemini. I think that's how I pronounce her name. Regan Nagarstani. I mean, they got a really amazing crew of people in it, and it's also illustrated, which is really lovely. And in fact, some of the essays really bounce off of the illustrations quite well. And it's presented as sort of, in some ways, an academic exercise, because there are quote-unquote fiction and quote-unquote nonfiction pieces. And there's a lot of discussion about what the book is organized around, which is this fictional cabinet of curiosities by this eccentric collector, Thackeray T. Lambshead. And what's great is that it almost has the feel of a shared world anthology and that sort of spirit, because everybody's talking about this fictional construct and all their stuff is sort of in quote unquote that world. But each of them really puts their own spin on it, and they're not linked in the way that a shared world anthology necessarily is, but the way that they bounce off of the central conceit, and sometimes, you know, to my surprise, really seem to mesh well with some of the other stuff that's in there. Just really, you know, really, really blew me away. I mean, one of my favorite Jeffrey Ford stories is in here, which is about a sort of, you know, loose saintly artifact, but really tends to be a lot more about questions of duty and getting old and a lot of other themes than anything else. And that's another great thing about it, is that while the stories all relate to supposedly items in the cabinet, they're about other things as well. And I thought, almost without exception, the authors in it did a really amazing job of doing both things at once, like contributing to this idea of the cabinet and this weird stuff, but using it to make really interesting points or to bring up really interesting emotions or, you know, create something you really would chew over long after you finish reading the story.
Mm.
And, you know, that to me is an exemplary kind of anthology that really does that. I mean, I was tempted to talk about The Weird, but it's so huge.
I know. I was thinking about The Weird and Time Traveler's Almanac, and I said, that's separate.
So huge. I mean, I would be here for an hour talking about The Weird.
You know, it's funny because that the Lamb's Head book, that was the follow-up to
Discredited Diseases,
yeah.
Which right. I was just looking at while we were talking before John brought it up, which is why I laughed.
And it was so weird because having read that, when I picked up Cabinet of Curiosities, you know, the whole idea of language rewiring the way you think, as soon as I picked up Cabinet of Curiosities, I just fell right back into that groove again. You know, it just instantly dropped me in there. And there's very few books that it was an anthology that had its own preparatory material, which was nice.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, the Vandermeers did a great job, not just with the strict editing, like selection of stories, but they really found something that the writers could sink their teeth into and make something of. And I thought that was just all around just a really one of my favorite anthologies.
Hmm.
And there were two, like Fred, I wanted to mention sort of more minorly. I have a real thing for dystopian stories. And I was going to talk a bit about some of Tom Dish's efforts in that area. But I realized that actually John Joseph Adams' Brave New Worlds is probably much broader in scope than some of those older anthologies are. And that's one of those hybrid sort of anthologies you're talking about. There are some reprints. I think some of them are original too.
Yeah.
Right.
Like the Carrie Vaughn story, I think, is original. And some others were as well. And I thought Adams, again, in terms of curation, did a really good job of finding pretty high quality stories. I mean, that's, again, a really strong anthology that I thought had, you know, there's very few stories that I didn't like in that. And it presented a really nice diversity of stories from really dark, heartless, you know, dystopias. I think the Jeff Ryman story falls in that category, and certainly Apollo Bacigalupi's story. But then there are stories like Carrie Vaughn's Amaryllis.
Yes.
That while they're dystopian, there's, you know, people are actually living their lives and getting by.
Yep.
And you don't see a lot of those kind of dystopian stories, especially nowadays where dystopia is so popular, but it seems to be more about, you know, segmented caste societies that are bringing us down. And if we all just had a little freedom, things would be okay.
Yeah.
And the great thing about the Brave New Worlds thing is I thought he really broke that sort of very narrow definition of what a dystopian story can do down. And he found stories that really take it from a bunch of different angles. Now, the other one I wanted to briefly mention was So Long Been Dreaming, which is subtitled Postcolonial Science Fiction and Fantasy. And that's edited by Neela Hopkinson and Upinder Mehan. And that's another one that has an organizing principle that's fairly unique. But the great thing, again, about that is that they found really interesting stories to pull together for that theme. And again, you see the central issue they're dealing with, which is the idea of sort of post-coloniality and colonialism and the effects on our, basically our imaginations. And really pull together a really good crop of stories that tackle it from different angles, different sensibilities, different cultural perspectives, but are also really readable and enjoyable. So it's interesting that I went through a lot of anthologies for this podcast, and I really, really was surprised how many I would start to read and go, it's okay. nice. And then what I ended up coming back to were ones that I had read previously and then found myself comparing these things too. It's like, you know, is this as good as Thackeray T. Lamb's Head? No, not really. I think I'm just going to talk about that. And it comes back to this idea that I've been dealing with, you know, where is the really strong writing coming from nowadays? And it seems with stuff like those kind of anthologies, you really see the short form as being much more adventurous, getting much more to the point and really responding socially and culturally more deftly than novels. So.
And have you come to any conclusions in that thought yet?
No, I mean, like I said, I think I'm really finding more and more that the short form is giving me what I want in terms of a fantastic literature.
Mm.
I'm still finding great novels here and there to read, but it really seems that people are taking more chances and are interested in making the sort of tougher calls narratively and thematically in short fiction. And what's really interesting to me is that some of those stories stay with me much more than novels I have read. I mean, and part of that is, you know, the narrative the condensing of the narrative often means you deliver the climax, you deliver the sort of the point you want to make much more sharply with a short story than you do with a novel often. And that will definitely make it linger for you. I mean, certainly in terms of how people's brains work, if you get delivered a much sort of sharper sort of point like that, you can hang on to it much more adeptly than something that took a much longer time to come together. But it was just weird looking at older anthologies, including some I'd really liked when I was younger, and saying, wow, I thought that was really kind of mind-blowing at the time, and maybe it was. But it seems that there's other stuff that's been coming together since that, not just in terms of like time and being outmoded or not, but just in terms of what they do with their words. It just seems much stronger and much more, you know, points are being much more sharply made. And since that's what I really look for, I think, in fiction is I want someone to make a really sharp, interesting point. And maybe I'll learn something I hadn't learned before. Since that's what I'm often looking for in fiction, I'm really finding shorter stuff is doing that for me. And anthologies that are more thematically organized, not in terms of a very specific focus, but in terms of a sort of a broader theme. So like, I think Brave New Worlds and So Long Been Dreaming work because you're not just talking about like a thing. Like it's not just, you know, an anthology about trees or something like that. It's broad enough that there's a lot you can do with it. But at the same time, it often focuses the points you want to make and maybe even some of the motifs you want to employ.
Wow.
Yeah. So even more so than some of the best of stuff that I've read lately, I think those kind of anthologies are producing more interesting writing for the most part. So any final thoughts on that subject?
Well, I had a couple things I wanted to mention real quick. You know, I have to go back and qualify one of my statements. Doing a quick reread of my bookshelves, I realized that over 200 number I have, that only counts Ellen Datlow anthologies. So I have to go back and do a census. But if I got to pick one out of there on this particular time, in the particular mood I'm in, I got to pick Vanishing Acts, which was the book she did, I believe, in 2000, which was a series of stories involving extinction. And she reprinted a few things that she had grabbed from, that she had brought into Omni, listening to Brahms by Susie McNeed-Charnas and Faded Roses by Karen Joy Fowler being the two prominent ones. But I think this is the first place that I ever read Ted Chiang, actually, was 72 Letters was in here. And Brian Stableford's Tenebrio, another standout in that one. Jack Dann and Gardner Desois did one of the Ace anthologies. It was called Futures Past, and it was about going back and actually changing history. It was time travel stories where the past is actually altered. This was another one which mixed new stories with reprints, and it had Killing the Morrow by Robert Reed and lots of really good stuff. Hotel at Harlan's Landing by Cage Baker was on here. I think this was 2002 this came out. I'm sorry, 2006 that came out. And out of all the various Ace ones, this is one that's really a standout. And one of the more contemporary ones that I really liked was from a few years back. It came out by Daw. It came out in 2010. It was called Is Anybody Out There? It was by Nick Givers and Marty Halpern. And it was basically stories about SETI and looking for life and the Drake Equation and the Fermi Paradox. Lots of really good stuff in here. Once again, it kind of went all over the place. Galaxy of Mirrors by Paul DeFilippo was in here, which I really like. Standout for me in here was called The Vampires of Paradox by James Morrow, which was about as true to being a James Morrow, about as stereotypical of a James Morrow story as one could pick. It's very, very rarefied in the way it takes real world problems and contemporary culture and distills them into a very Morrow-esque take when it comes to how the universe actually works. And one other one I want to throw out there real quick, it was called After Tranquility. It was the second anthology that was put out by Orion's Arm, which is a kind of a shared universe, far future, post-human website, encyclopedia, world-building exercise. And they did a couple anthologies that were basically stories from various parts of this very, very deep future history. Most of it was primarily by authors who are either scientists or not that well known. There was an Andrew Sandberg story in there and a few others. And it was kind of interesting, people spending all this time building a big, giant, galaxy-wide culture and then breaking in and doing a number of stories based on it. It was kind of fun. Nothing truly stands out for me, but they're all very interesting takes on just little snippets of a far future history, and I really liked it.
Fred.
All right, I'll just mention one previous guest on The Three Horsemen, because three of the stories in this most recent anthology have ended up in my Hugo nomination list, and that's Jonathan Strawn's Infinity series. He's got a new one coming in December. I urge people to look for it. I enjoyed each of the three previous volumes, and like I said, three stories that I've nominated were from one single collection, and that's edited by Jonathan Strawn. And that's a good example of a single editor who puts a really good stamp on an anthology. And then the other two that I wanted to mention briefly were both shared worlds that took place on a single world and only ended up being one volume in length. And that was Medea, which was a Harlan Ellison project, and Murasaki, which was a Robert Silverberg project. And both had similar genesis in that people like Hal Clement, Paul Anderson, and Fred Pohl provided the background, the scientific background, the hard foundation upon which to build. And then a number of authors were involved in writing a series of stories about those single worlds. Murasaki is probably easier to find than Medea. If you ever come across the limited edition of Medea, grab it.
Yeah, definitely.
But beautiful artwork in Medea, great nonfiction essays. The introductions to both, along with the introductions that are in the Wildcard books, the Thieves' World books, as well as two Ellison books, one his screenplay for iRobot, and one his essay in Phoenix Without Ashes about how the Star-Lorst came not to be, are highly recommended reading for anybody who's involved in a shared world project or a media project. I mean, good. All those things are good cold doses of reality about dealing with lots of egos. And I mean, you know, the military taught me how to lead men. Well, not really, but, you know, at least work with groups of people. I think a lot of authors or editors don't have that experience, and it's interesting to read some of these books, you know, the introductions, and see, you know, how much like herding cats it all is.
You know, not just that, but Medea is, because of the fact that it has the transcripts of the actual world building
of the event, right?
Stuff mm-hmm. like that. That, you know, just like Lamb's Head, that's an anthology that comes with its own preparatory material.
Yes.
And the fact that those are like two pretty prominent examples, but they take completely different takes, you know, on fantastic literature. And I'm actually wondering what other type of expressions of that might exist. You know, are there other anthologies or shared worlds or anything along those lines that come with their own briefing ahead of time before you dive into them? So.
I'm sure there are, but those are the two examples that I could think of, which is why I put them on my list.
Excellent.
Yep.
All right. Well, shall we turn then to culture consumed?
If we must.
We don't have to, but we can.
Yeah, we should.
My list is quite short, actually, so I'm going to go first. Because I spent so much of my time in the past few weeks reading old anthologies. I didn't read a lot of new stuff, but one thing I did read and finish with a lot of delight was Nicola Griffith's Hild, mm-hmm. which was really, really good. I mean, I had heard it hyped, and I wasn't quite sure what to expect, but I knew that it was sort of not, quote unquote, not really, you know, fantasy. It's, you know, there aren't like, you know, wizards firing fireballs or anything like that. But it has an interesting sensibility to it that puts you in the mindset of the people who are living in this historical period, and where, you know, a young girl who is really smart and can sort of, you know, read people and read the lay of the land, as it were, can be thought of as a seer. And she puts herself in a position, well, partly her mom has a lot to do with it too. Her mother is quite the conspirator. But she makes a name for herself as the king's seer. And what this book does that I think is very interesting is it takes a basically a child protagonist and shows, I think more convincingly than any novel I've read yet, what a precocious child, what it be like to be a precocious child, basically. I think, you know, Griffith has a really strong command of her characters, and every word feels very intentional, and that it's funny to say that when on the surface and you read this book, it feels like quite often not a lot is happening. The pace doesn't seem very quick. There are some moments of violence that basically happen off screen, like out of sight of the reader, but that have a significant impact on the characters in the story. But every word seems so carefully chosen and placed that everything just builds. And you find yourself oddly gripped by, like I said, what on the surface doesn't seem to be like a story with a lot of, you know, high velocity action or huge amounts of overblown tension or anything like that. It really builds very well. And you know, I think that's probably the best novel I've read so far this year. Maybe early yet, but I mean, I was just really, as a reader and as a writer, really blown away.
No.
And that's about the only thing I read that wasn't something in preparation for the podcast. I went through a lot of anthologies and read two or three stories, and then was like, I moved on. So,
same here.
You know, I mean, I reread some comics. I reread Marvels. If people don't know, I think I mentioned this last time, but Scrib now has a pretty large comic library added to its service, and I've been availing myself of that. And that's one thing that I reread as well. I mean, I have it in regular form too, but I reread Marvels just to sort of see. It's been a while since I read it, to see what it was like, and I still like it. Mm-hmm. I'm a little less enamored of the story than I had been before, but the art is just so amazing. But that was pretty much it for Culture Consume for me. Fred?
Well, March was the cruelest month, so I only was able to read one book this month so far. I've got a lot underway, but only finished one. And that was a reread of A Talent for War by Jack McDivitt, mostly because he has a book up for the Nebula this year, and it's been so long since I've started that series that I wanted to start rereading it. Enjoyed it. It gave me lots of ideas actually for running a role-playing game adventure for the Traveler role-playing system. So we'll see if I take that anywhere. And other than the usual titles in the graphic end of things that I've been reading, like Ms. Marvel and Captain Marvel and Avengers, and by the way, my daughter's like somewhere in the 200s on X-Men at this point, I think. the one thing I've read was Star Wars 3, Darth Vader 1 and 2, and Princess Leia 1 and 2 from Marvel. Mm. And what really amused me is each one of these has that crawl that the movies use.
Yeah.
And it's hilarious to read the three different crawls, because like the Princess Leia one's like, you know, after saving the galaxy with the help of an annoying pilot and a yokel farm boy from a desert planet, Princess Leia moved on to, you know, other adventures. So, and of course, Darth Vader's one is like, you know, after, you know, exactly the opposite of the Star Wars one, etc. So, interesting stuff.
I've been really liking that Darth Vader book.
Yeah.
The Leia one's been good, but I got to see where the story goes.
Yeah. I mean, the Darth Vader one, they're definitely laying some interesting threads. Yeah. Without saying much.
Yeah, the Darth one, I'm really excited.
In fact, I like both of those better than the main Star Wars one.
Yeah. That first storyline did not need to be three issues. That could have been done. That could have been done in one if it was well done. So if Mark Waid had been writing it, it would have been done in one. So
I'm curious to see whether they're going to do Han Solo and Chewbacca spinoff as well.
Hmm.
Or maybe Lando before Lando meets up with them or something.
I think they'll probably wait till the end of the first year at this point.
Right.
They've already got their artist for the main book lined up after issue 6. And as good as I've enjoyed seeing John Cassidy's art in that book, I'd like to see some other artists take on it. Yeah, a little bit of decompression going on in that particular thing right now, but we'll see how it goes.
Yep. And that's it for me.
But the Darth book is really good. I got the only book, I'm about two-thirds of the way through The Fifth Heart by Dan Simmons, and I don't know if he intended this or not, but I'm laughing my ass off reading this book. It's basically Henry James meets Sherlock Holmes, a Sherlock Holmes who is convinced he's a fictional character, and the two of them go to Washington, D.C., so that Holmes can solve a mystery involving a dear friend of Henry James. And as with all of the historical books that Simmons has done, lots of very granular history involved. But the interaction between Holmes and Holmes' penchant for ridiculous disguises and stuff like that, and the fact that Holmes is clueless when it comes to a lot of things about, quote-unquote, the real world, that Henry James has to educate him in, such as not understanding how if presidents are elected every 4 years, how a president can have two terms and stuff like this. Really good so far, and I'm looking to see where it goes from here. Comic-wise, a couple things I got to mention. Number one, Nameless is the new comic by Grant Morrison with art by Chris Burnham. It's a very strange Lovecraftian space exploration story. We are 2 issues into it, which means it's probably another issue or two before it implodes like so many other Grant Morrison books. But so far, I've been enjoying it. Something I went back and read, which I had not read, was Mimetic by James Tynion IV and Eric Donovan, which is about one day a very strange image starts popping up on social medias of this sloth on a weird 3D background, and 12 hours after you see it, you start to go insane. The only two people who are immune are two POV characters who are immune out of everyone who's immune are a kid with color blindness and a retired army scientist who's been slowly losing his sight due to a degenerative disease. Really dark, but some really nice moments. The younger POV character, his boyfriend, it's pretty obvious to the reader that the boyfriend has already actually seen the image and is just counting down time until it goes. But it also talks about the various little movements that take place inside of humanity as this moving 12-hour window starts to travel forward. And it takes place over the course of 3 days. 3 issues, really good. I'm assuming it's going to be out in paperback soon if it's not already collected. Just discovered something last week, a digital-only comic called Universe! ! By Albert Montes. It is available from Panel Syndicate as a pay-what-you-want. These are little self-contained science fiction stories, and they are wonderful. They are drawn in a very cartoony style. The second one in particular has to do with robots learning to discover love for their human owners. Highly recommend it. Very, very good stuff. I really hope this stuff gets traction. Invisible Republic, first issue of that came out by Gabriel Hardman and Corin Becco. Neat little science fiction story about kind of colonialism and survival. It's one of those stories that I really need to see. A lot of it has been, it's stuff we've seen before. But it's got my interest in the way it's taking its approach, and I want to see where that goes. Going back to time travel, 8 with the G in 8 replaced with the number 8 is a time travel story by Raphael Albuquerque and Mike Johnson, and about a guy with amnesia who is sent to a place called the Meld, which we're supposed to believe it's the future, but it might possibly be the past. And he has to do something involving a despot who seems to be running everything in the period. Very, very quirky. Not just an unreliable narrator, but pretty much all the characters are unreliable, which has made it interesting. And once again, I really want to see where he's taking this story. Mm-hmm. One last thing, Red One, which is by Xavier Dorison with Terry Dodson. In the 70s, the Russians decided that Americans were so enamored with superheroes that they wanted to send one of their female agents to the U.S. to become a superhero. The first issue is basically them training her and then sending her. And she basically has to go and get a series of jobs. She has to create her own origin story. She just doesn't go there and appear as a superhero. She has to basically create her own origin story. And it's how she ends up getting a job in L.A. and things along those lines. And once again, very, very quirky with a lot of 1970s anachronisms running through it. First issue of that just came out last week, I believe. And, really sharp stuff. A lot of really good kind of under the radar science fiction comics, have been appearing, and there's several more that are going to be, coming up in the next month or so before the whole before the big two have their massive universe-changing crossovers that are going to be coming up. So it's kind of nice seeing these nice little self-contained science fiction and fantasy tales sort of riding in that you can enjoy without having to lug all the baggage around.
Nice. Excellent. Well, any closing thoughts?
Ooh. There's a lot of there's a lot of Ace anthologies. My God, there's so many of them. There's so many of them. Left-Handed Warriors, Volume 3, and stuff like that.
That's my favorite.
Yeah, I know it is. Much better than number 2. Yeah, it's you know, we could go on for, we could take any sub flavor of anthologies, and maybe we will, and talk about those at some point in the future. But it's such a broad palette, and I personally didn't realize what we were getting into when I started doing the back reading, and all these little categorizations started falling onto me. So
That's why at one point I had sort of asked both of you, are we just looking at, you know, themed anthologies or collections, single author collections? Or, I mean, we all ended up pretty much talking about, obviously, collections of multi-author works. But
I mean,
we could probably do a whole nother show on
Cthulhu or Holmes, you know?
Right.
Both had, you know, I literally think Cthulhu anthologies are multiplying exponentially lately.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's becoming or if it hasn't already been designated as basically a subgenre now.
Yeah.
To the point where I'm hearing about backlash against it.
Yep.
So that means it's come of age, because now people are revolting. So, you know.
Cthulhu or the new zombies? What?
After the revolution comes the counter-revolution.
Yep.
I still like, I think.
And then reprisals.
I think it was Cthulhu Ascendant, which was the one that was only stories about after the old ones arrive.
Oh, right, yeah.
I really like that one. So.
Well, this should have been pretty short, right? Oh, they're here, we're dead. Next story. They're here, we're dead. Next
story. They were, there was a pretty good variety in there.
Yeah, there's even there's a novel with that theme, isn't there? Move Underground.
Oh yeah.
Nick Mamatis's, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I have not gotten a copy of yet, but I keep meaning to, because I like Nick's writing. But yeah, I mean, there's we could have gone into, you know, any of a whole pile of different sort of sub themes, but I like talking about generally what we think of anthologies, and then seeing what we each decided to focus on,
mm-hmm.
to sort of exemplify what we like about anthologies. So I thought that was pretty good. I think with that, we can probably say goodnight.
Yep.
Thank you all for listening. I hope you have all enjoyed this session of the Three Horsemen podcast, and we'll be back in April with something. Surprise. Surprise is in store for you all in the coming month.
Including us.
Including us, that's right. So, thanks for listening, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.